Shalom Aleichem, everyone. I'm happy to welcome us back for conference call, believe it or not, number 7. And we thank Rabbi Willig for being with us on this call. And Rabbi, it's all yours.
Thank you. I apologize for being a little bit late. I'm here in the yeshiva, and a lot of things happened after Mincha, so I was just pulled for a few places. I apologize again. Let us begin without any further ado. Very topical question. Each Purim, we are inundated with many shalach manos from the community. It has become a very big burden on my wife, our time, and our finances to reciprocate. Other than disappearing from the community altogether on Purim, what would be a good way to deal with this without hurting the congregants' feelings? Excellent question. The answer seems to be quite obvious. There is no obligation to reciprocate. Never does it say in Shulchan Aruch that someone gives you shalach manos that you're required to give them shalach manos. There's no such obligation. It's just a matter of discretion. So every person has to understand the limitations on his time, on his wife, on his and their finances, and act accordingly. No more than that. Now, if people's feelings are hurt, you know, it can be said that, you know, that it's just it's just impossible for there to be this kind of reciprocation. There are a number of ways that can be solved. One, if it's the finances question, they can give the rabbi a raise so he can have enough money to finance shalach manos for everybody. As far as the wife and the time, they can be pre-purchased shalach manos, which don't require too much time to set up and give out. There are many ways to skin the cat, but a rabbi's first responsibility is to his family, certainly to his wife, and her time and his time, and finances have to be responsible. And so if people's feelings are hurt after Purim, what happened? Just tell them the reality. I don't have the money. I don't have the time. My wife doesn't have the ability to make shalach manos, and I just can't do it. Yes, there's a mitzvah of shalach manos, so that person can, the rabbi can fulfill like anybody else. One person, mishloach manos ishterei ehu, to one individual. If you can't find someone in the shul to whom to give it without hurting people's feelings, to give it to someone outside the shul. So a low plug. This is, of course, in a drastic case where it becomes a very big burden, which is too much. Every person knows his own situation, his wife's own situation, his time, his finances. You have to know what to do. Every case is different. Obviously, it'll depend on so many factors. If you have a shul with 800 members, it's almost logistically impossible to have so many shalach manos distributed from the house. It's just an impossibility. If you have a smaller group, it's easier. Now, I'll just give you some personal experience in my own community. I have a small shul, relatively. Some people have much bigger shuls, some are smaller than mine. And it was considered a burden. My wife is very talented and creative and always comes up with some new ideas. It was getting a little bit burdensome, to be honest. What happened was, a number of years ago, a group from the shul decided they want to ease the burden on everybody, and they made what they call community shul-sponsored shalach manos. People sign up, and they pass a list around of 100 and something people, and you can give to one person, two people, to everybody for a certain amount of money, and it's just done automatically. And that cuts down the number of people coming to my house, because people who felt they had to come, how could they not come to the Rav's house in Purim? Now they say the Yotze, by signing their name on the huge list of people who want to give the rabbi shalach manos, without having to come to my house, of course, if they don't have to reciprocate, they don't come to my house. That's a particular idea which wasn't my initiative, but it happened, and it did ease our burden somewhat, insofar as there are fewer people coming, because those who put their names on, some of them feel they don't have to come. Some still come. Everyone has to know his own community. In my house, the house is open the whole day Purim. People are coming in from morning till evening, or till afternoon anyway, and they say Divrei Torah, and we sing, and we dance, and we play music, and And it's a very nice spirit of happiness, and included in the, is Shalach Malas. But everyone has to know his own circumstances, and there's no obligation whatsoever to reciprocate. If someone gives you, and you don't have, you ran. I ran out. The rabbi makes 10 Shalach Malas. The first kol hakodem zocha. I say, I'm sorry, I ran out. Or else what you can do is recycle. It's another option. People give you Shalach Malas, just take off the name and just recycle. Give it around. People get their own Shalach Malas back at the end of the day. So they'll understand. The rabbis can only make 10 Shalach Malas. That's all she has the time for, the money for, or put the number 20, 50, whatever number there is. You run out, just give out, give back what's come to you. All these are possibilities. You have to know your own circumstances. Okay. That's the first question. Next question. I'm a finalist for a shul and my prob is coming up. I've been informed that there is a shul member becoming a Baal Tshuva these past few years. He is married, a father, and a grandfather. However, his wife is not Jewish, and from what I have been told, she has never converted by any branch. I have not spoken with the previous rabbi. However, during his tenure, he had prohibited the granting of a kibbutz to this member. I know that there's an issue with some of the shul members, yet others would have no objection to him receiving a kibbutz. This may come up as in a private conversation with the shul leadership. A. Is there any halachic room to grant him a kibbutz, and if yes, which? B. Even if there is room, should I be opening this door? C. If the answer is no, what would be the best way to explain it? All excellent questions. Only thing is, they were discussed at significant length. We're now at conference call number 7. Way back in conference call number 1 and number 2, these issues were discussed, and I'm not going to repeat the specifics of what can be given to individuals who are not observing these halachas. We even had a leniency to give an individual an aliyah as long as the aliyah doesn't discuss the particular sin that he is committing. But there are also positions that say limigdar milsa, to prevent intermarriage, we shouldn't be giving any kibbutzim to such an individual. We shouldn't be letting him into the shul. Shouldn't give him membership. There are many different ways to approach this situation. But what are you doing to prove? That's the question. So, if they ask you the question, you say as follows. It's impossible to answer this question without knowing all the circumstances and all the personalities. Obviously, a candidate on a prove is not privy to these circumstances and these personalities. If you're asked what should be done in the interim, there's a famous rule called Chazaka. The interim, the ruling of the previous rabbi, would be that which would be followed. However, it's possible that a change would take place under your rabbinic leadership after you gather all the information about the personalities and about the circumstances. But right now, you're not in a position to say any more than that because you simply don't have the facts before you. I wouldn't say any more than that in a problem. Okay, let us go on to the next question. I'm finalizing a contract with my kehillah. I've been the Mara D'Asra now for 8 years and want to protect myself by adding a clause of severance to receive Chodesh L'Shana if we part ways. Some chaverim have told me that Rav Moshe's stipulation for Chodesh Hashanah was only for Mechanchim, not Rabbanim. Is that true? Also, if it is not in my contract, nor any other agreement written about severance, can I assume that in rabbinic contract some form of severance is a given? Again, excellent questions. Let's start with the last sentence. Nothing is a given. Absolutely nothing can be assumed. Zero. Even if you'll tell me that according to Rav Moshe, a rabbi is the same as a mechanech, not everyone agrees to the psak of Rav Moshe. And of course, the famous rule, you all know, hamotzi mechaveir olavaraya. So if a rabbi wants to extract severance from a shul when it's not in the contract, and he invokes tshuvas igros Moshe, doesn't mean he's going to prevail. Now, if the rabbi is insisting and is very firm, absolutely, he must be given severance of Chodesh Hashanah, then it should be written in the contract. And if everyone agrees, the rabbi agrees, the shul agrees, that there'll be a chodesh Hashana, if there's a situation of severance, that'll be wonderful, that'll be great. Write it in the contract. On the other hand, the shul may refuse to write it in the contract. And then, if the rabbi signs a contract anyway, any person looking at the situation that the rabbi asked that severance be written in the contract, the congregation refused to put it in the contract, and he signed the contract anyway, a Din Torah hearing such a case might easily reach a conclusion that the rabbi is Meichel, because if he wasn't Meichel, he shouldn't have agreed to the contract after he asked for it and they turned him down. That's a possibility, so it can make it worse for the rabbi if he asks for the severance to be written in the contract and encounters a refusal and is not willing to leave now. More than that, it's possible that the very request to have severance, Chodesh Hashanah, written in the contract can cause discomfiture, whether it's written or not written, and it may even harm the proper relationship between the shul and its rav. And in the worst case scenario, chas v'shalom, it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. A shul that didn't have even a thought of severing the rabbi. Oh, the rabbi's talking about severance. Okay, we'll sever him. So they can end up losing the whole job over this request. That could happen. Now, if the rabbi is being paid with a pension, X percent of his income or a fixed amount is added to the absolute salary, that would be an additional reason in a Beis Din to exempt the shul from having to pay severance. You know, the Torah Mesorah is big into this Chodesh Hashanah. Even wrote a whole sefer called Chodesh Hashanah and collected signatures from many, many people. I did not sign on it because it seems to me that in many parts of our community, Chodesh Hashanah is not accepted. I received a question from a particular individual who's active in a school, and the school is a very old school. It's maybe, 80 years old, and they never paid severance to anybody, certainly not Chodesh Hashanah. So now if a person says, but it says in the Torah Mesorah guidelines, Chodesh Hashanah, the school will say, not in my backyard. We never gave Chodesh Hashanah. People have been coming and going for nearly a century. So it's, again, I'm not sure if they could go to a Din Torah. If they've come to me, I would certainly take this into very careful consideration. So therefore, it's hard to expect any guaranteed result. But in any event, if there's no pension, it seems to me, instead of the rabbi asking for severance, it's more appropriate to ask for a pension. That everyone understands. You know, not every person in the shul that knows about severance. Many of them don't have severance packages in their whatever their occupations happen to be. But pensions is very pervasive in this country, and the rabbi, in fact, should be entitled to some kind of a pension, and that will protect the family, which is the bottom line. You want to protect yourself. A pension offers some measure of protection in a different way, which seems to me is less adversarial, is more accepted in this country. Now, obviously, everything I said until now is purely in the category of an etza, of advice. It's not a psak. And here, I'm saying, repeating what I said in the last question, it all depends upon the circumstances, it depends upon the personalities, of which I'm obviously unaware. So the advice that I gave may not be the best advice in this circumstance, but that's what I think, without knowing any more facts, that's what I would say. Okay, the next question. I was asked by the daughter of a congregant regarding the fact that her male roommate will use their kitchen during Pesach for chametz. Where may I draw the line and say I can't answer this question? She is rooming with a male, probably for financial reasons. That sounds very strange. Just as college roommates. He doesn't keep kosher on his own. He is presumably not Shomer Shabbos. And now she considers it a shaila because he will use the kitchen for chametz on Pesach. Any insight would be helpful. It seems to me you cannot answer this question at all. Can't. It's like, you know, a person's in violation of such a serious prohibition and now wants you to buy into that situation. In effect, validated by relating to a local question within that situation and answering a small question. I would never answer such a question. On the other hand, you can shift it to this individual by saying, I cannot answer your question. I'll answer what we call today a theoretical, a hypothetical. Instead of having a male roommate, which I will refuse to discuss, and she'll understand why, and she'll maybe take a little musa, I'll discuss a female roommate. That's a theoretical question, which the same chametz-related issues exist irrespective of gender. And, of course, this hypothetical involves a female roommate who doesn't keep kosher on her own, doesn't keep Shabbos. So what is the answer? The answer is as follows. If the chametz belongs to this friend and not to the daughter of the congregant who's speaking to you, there is no responsibility on the part of the questioner for chametz owned by her roommate. She, the questioner, is not in violation of Bayra and Bayimate. If her female roommate, that's the question you're answering, owns chametz. Now, on the other hand, it would be prohibited for her to live in that room on Pesach. It's a mokum shemachnisim chametz, and there's no bedikas chametz. So Tosis explains on that Beis and Psochim, that if you live in that room for a week and there's chametz all around, the fear is you may mistakenly eat some of that chametz. So therefore, if there's no bedika being done, there's chametz all around, you may not occupy those premises on Pesach. When you come back after Pesach, well then, the question implies, the question says, doesn't keep kosher on his, or we'll say her, own. Implying that in the room itself, the person does keep kosher. That's the arrangement that the parties have to enable them to live together in the same room, in the same apartment. Well, if that is the case, the roommate should be told that she's not permitted to cook chametz on Pesach. And just as presumably there is the proper understanding all year long not to bring non-kosher food or to not to cook non-kosher food in the utensils that are being used, so you have to assume that the same cooperation will exist on Pesach. And if you're assuming that the kalim are kosher now, notwithstanding the fact that the roommate does not keep kosher on her own, but would be keeping kosher in this particular room, so that assumption would be valid as far as Pesach is concerned. So whatever pots and pans and dishes are presumed kosher now, they can be presumed kosher after Pesach as well. Obviously, if you know for a fact that chametz was cooking them on Pesach, you would have to kasher them. And if you're in doubt, so then there's room to be lenient on the grounds that chametz sh'ovra all over Pesach is a rabbinic prohibition. It's called a knas, a fine. It's not even on the level of a regular rabbinical prohibition. When you're in doubt, there's room to be somewhat lenient. But again, this is in a situation where you're not sure what the facts were the pots used or not used. If you know they were used, you have to kash them. If you're sure they're not used, there's no problem. If you're in doubt, it depends, you know, a little bit again on the circumstances, whether the person is credible when they claim that the pots haven't been used is being made. But once again, to go back to the beginning, I would never answer such a question with regard to a male congregant. I would say to the questioner, I'm sorry, a male roommate is not acceptable according to Jewish law. I'll answer your question in a different case, a hypothetical case, a theoretical case, in which there is a female roommate. That we can discuss, and that, the answer I gave is what you should be telling this daughter of the congregant who's asking you the question. And once again, there could be changes in circumstances and personalities, which I'm obviously not aware of, and that could alter the answer somewhat. Okay. If there is a broken engagement between two parties, does it have to be some type of mechila or shtar? What are parameters? Now, strictly speaking, there's no need for any such thing. An engagement breaks. It breaks. In certain circles, especially what we call today Haredi circles, there is a custom that a shtar mechila be signed by the chosna and the kala in order to facilitate shiduchim in the future. There is a document. I have it in my house. I've been involved in a few broken engagements for people from my shul. And when a request was made to have this document signed, so I arranged it to be signed. He signs it, she signs it, they exchange copies of it, and they sign in front of two witnesses. They exchange the gift to one another. Nothing wrong with that. If a person on the call needs a particular document, you can probably get it just as I got it. Probably by now it's probably on the internet somewhere. There's no absolute halachic requirement for such a thing to happen, but in certain circles it is accepted, and they won't quote read a shidduch, end quote, with someone who was engaged the last yavashtar mechila. And you may say, what's that? And in many circles that's an apt question. What's that? There are many cases in our part of the world, a couple breaks up, no shtar mechila. And the chosn and the kala get engaged again and get married again and live happily ever after. So this is not a halacha. It's very important to understand that engagement has no absolute halachic standing. Unfortunately, it's a quirk of modern Hebrew that the word for engagement in modern Hebrew is erusin. That is really unfortunate. You know, I don't know if this when Ben Yehuda, whoever it was who made up the modern Hebrew vocabulary, it's a terrible, terrible expression. And it's used in the most Haredi circles. I've seen it in the Haredi newspapers. They put ads, Ploni and Plonis, Mu'urasim. That's modern Hebrew. They're engaged. But the word Erusin in Chumash means married. We all know that. Nara Mu'urasa, she's married. Yes, there's a distinction between Erusin and Nisuin, that Erusin is what we call an Eishes Ish Bebeis Ha'av, as the Pesukim in Parshas Matos teach us, and Nisuin is Eishes Ish Bebeis Ha'bal. That is certainly true. But at the same time, it's an unfortunate usage of the word, and there were certain Rabbanim who objected to a similar use of a word, in Yiddish. Those who are not speaking Hebrew would use the word Mu'urasin or Erusin, but they'll call him a chosin and call her a kala. That's ubiquitous, and everyone uses that expression, which is also unfortunate, because chosin and kala is found in the Chumash, and in the halacha refers to someone who's already married. It's also unfortunate. There are those who insist you call him Mishudachim. That, yes, the proper word is the shidduch was done, that they are, you know, you want to use the word miyuad, they're designated. I saw that word in letters of Ariel Levine to Rav Yosha, which are printed in the Sefer, before he was married. Hamiyuad lios chasani. He was designated to become my son-in-law. But these phrases, miyuad and meshudach, are not going to fly in common parlance. We're not going to change the world. We're going to use the expression chasam kala and use the word, if they speak in Hebrew, mu'u asim. It's not in our power, I don't think, to change common usage. But at the same time, it's critical that we understand that engagement is not an official status, and therefore no shtar mechila is required. Now, it is true that if they signed official shtar tanoim, may have a different status. In my part of the world, they only have what they call Rav Moshe's tanoim, which is signed at the wedding. And Rav Moshe's tanoim say basically nothing. It just says that he will marry her and she will marry him this particular day. They want to kind of hide from each other and they'll live in peace, etc. And it's signed by the two fathers, by Adam, attested to the Kabbalah's Kinyan. But the two fathers would pick up a handkerchief, etc. That's just really zero. And in any event, that's only at the night of the at the day of the wedding. I have never been at a wedding where they broke it up after the tanoim was signed at the wedding. I'm told there's certain cases that may have existed in history, but I've never been at one at such an occasion. So in situations that I'm familiar with, nothing has been signed before the wedding, and therefore there would be no need for any documents. Now, if they did have what they call today a vort or a tanoim or a lechayim, and they sign some papers, and they sometimes read it at, I've been at such occasions where they read it at the time of the engagement. In such a circumstance, it's probably a good idea to have some kind of a shtar mechila, because there's a shtar on the books which says certain things. Now, usually, the shtar which is signed at an earlier time may actually have things of some substance. There is a very common form of tanoim, not Rav Moshe's, we took out everything, but it has the more traditional tanoim, still used to this day in many Hasidish or some yeshivish circles, and they have many interesting things there. But even that, they took out a lot of the harsh language which came from the original source in the Sefer called Nachla Shiva, which has a real tanoim. And there it says, whoa, that if a party backs out, there's a cherem, and there's also a knas, and the cherem will not pata the knas, and the knas will not pata the cherem. Very, very strong language is used in that document. And it makes sense that if something breaks up, then there should be a shtar mechila. No one should come after you as if you're in cherem and in knas, and they'll have to hope that the mechila will help for the knas. That certainly helps for financial penalty. You still have to hope that it'll help for the cherem too, although it's not obviously as clear as it might otherwise be. Now, what's taken out of the these documents, even the ones that have some substance, is largely this expression of cherem and knas, and the amount of the knas. You usually won't find it even in today's more elaborate tanoim, more than Rav Moshe has, except that you go back to the old ones, and they tell you explicitly what the knas is. It can be either a dollar amount, it could be a percentage of the nadan, of the wedding expenses. It could be all kinds of different things they're written in different places. And then there has to really be a mechila. Otherwise, you have to pay the money. I remember 40 years ago, perhaps even more, I guess more by now, a fellow from our yeshiva was engaged to a daughter of a wealthy fellow. And they wrote an actual tanoim. And I was told that in the tanoim they wrote that if either party backs out, they will pay to the other party a sum of $100,000. Now we're talking 40-something years ago. That's big money. What happened was, the daughter broke the shidduch, and her father was a gentleman, wrote out a check for $100,000 and gave it to the chassan. So as we said at the time, the chassan was very jilted and distraught and upset. But you know, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. He was able to take it because he got a large check from the one who would have been his father-in-law. So these are formal documents, you know, which people have acted on in my time. And in that case, you would have to have a shtar mechila to make sure they're not going to come after you later on to ask for money. And then maybe they will, in fact, will ask for money. They won't sign a shtar mechila. But you give them the money. And the truth is, technically speaking, they're right. If you agree to pay X dollars if it breaks up and you don't do it, why should they give you a shtar mechila? You didn't keep your side. And of course, there are all kinds of lengthy discussions in the poskim. Look at the Otra poskim at great length. When is a person permitted to break up a shidduch without suffering the knas or the cherem? They discover some new information which they didn't know beforehand. That's a whole different story. But in the case that we're describing over here, it doesn't say that that's the case. In a simple case, there doesn't have to be a mechila or a shtar, but again, in certain circles where it may hurt the man or lady down the road and finding a marriage partner, they'll say, where's the shtar mechila? Then it's wise to get one, and the rabbi should be wise enough to facilitate it. I want to repeat again that the expression of engagement should be clear, does not have a halachic standing. I must tell you that I rarely, if ever, correct a rabbi who's in Masada Kiddush. It's not my job to. I've seen many, many mistakes. It's not my job. I'm not in charge. I made an exception when a rabbi, who should have known better, got up at a wedding and said, we're going to now have the wedding. The wedding consists of two parts. The first part, the erusin, the engagement. The ring is given from the chasen to the kala. And the second part, the nisuin, is the chuppah, which is the full marriage. I said to him, what did you say? That's a terrible mistranslation. It's not an engagement. Erusin is marriage. Now, they use the word betrothal. Even that's not really right. Betrothal comes from the notion of trust. It's also kind of the only plus of the word betrothal that no one knows what it means. So you can just say, well, all betrothal means is erusin. But technically speaking, even that's not a proper translation. Erusin is marriage. A woman is completely married, except that she is in the home of her father, and nisuan, she moves to the home of her husband. Okay, that's the last question. My congregant designated me to be his halachic decider on his living will. I then discovered that this was done only because of his false belief that I agreed with his opinion based on certain poskim regarding brain death. I do not agree with those poskim. Now, for purposes of the question, my understanding is that the congregant assumed that the rabbi accepted the brain death definition, but in fact, the rabbi does not accept the brain death definition. Now, it could be the reverse, that he thinks that the rabbi does not, and in fact it does. That would require a different answer. So whoever asked the question, I'm happy to talk about that if that's your intention, but more likely it's the other way around. So I'm going to answer the question that way. Should I, A, paskin as the patient wants against my own views, B, find a rabbi who can fulfill the wishes of the patient, C, paskin as I feel is right against the patient's wishes? So I believe the answer is no, no, and no. All three options are incorrect. And what should you do? Tell the truth. Assuming that I understand the question properly, should tell the rabbi who does not accept the brain death criterion, should tell the congregant that I don't accept the brain death criterion. Or if it's the reverse, you know, I'm not sure which way the mistake is going. And if he made a mistake and didn't understand you properly, his appointment of you as a halachic decider in his will is really based on a mistake. it's like a, forgive the expression, a mekach tos, a minui betos, and it probably is null and void. So he has a number of choices. He can now appoint to reappoint you on your terms. I'm assuming that you the rabbi do not accept the brain death criteria. Or he can appoint somebody else. Now, option number one is impossible. Option number one would indicate that a rabbi who does not accept the brain death criterion has to conduct himself as someone who would. Now, if you accept the brain death criterion, as soon as a person is called brain dead, it's called a chever kedisha. That's what some of the rabbis explain very emphatically. Time for the chever kedisha, even though the person is breathing, heart's pumping, calling the chever kedisha. How can you do that if you don't accept the brain death criterion? I don't see how it's possible. How can you possibly what the patient wants against your own view? I don't see it as a possibility at all. Okay. Now, let's go a little further. On the other hand, C, Paskin as I feel right is right against the patient's wishes, is also not right. Why? There is a rabbinic position out there. We all know about it. We've all read about it. We've seen pictures of rabbis and rebbetzins that seem to accept this. It's not right for you to paskin against the wishes of the congregant that he's alive when he is appointed because he thinks that you think that he's dead in such circumstances. That's just not right. It's just not right. I don't think it should be done. B, you should find the Rav who can fulfill the wishes of the patient and means that he's going to paskin that the patient is dead when you think he's alive. That's not right either. It's not your responsibility. You, the patient, are looking for a rabbi who accepts the brain death criterion. Very easy to find. Just look in the newspapers. There are many, many places where you can find a long list of such people. But let him find it on his own. It's not the job for the Rav who doesn't accept this criterion to find such a rabbi. You can find it on your own. You go. These days you go into the newspapers, you go online, you can find everything you want. If that's what he wants to do, even if you, the rabbi, think he's mistaken, it's not your job to forbid it. Now, if he's really asking your opinion, and you say that you don't accept the brain death criterion, so you should be in a position to explain to him why you don't accept the brain death criterion. So that goes to the core issue, which is, well, what's the brain death criterion based on? So there are three different reasons to accept the brain death criterion. The first one is that death is defined as someone who is immobile. Mutol ke'evin dome. Someone who doesn't move, that's considered to be dead. This is what I believe Rabbi Rabinovich of Malei Adumim wrote many years ago, that since a person doesn't move, so he's considered to be dead. Of course, this is a questionable assumption. The patient actually is moving. Now, of course, the breathing, that's not, you can't say he's moving. He's being moved by a machine. But as a result of that, the heart is pumping normally. The body can even move certain, we call them integrated movements, not just spasms, what we call pirchus. For those who are in the sugya, it's called the Lazarus syndrome. It comes from a different religion, but it's been known to happen. The person who was pronounced brain dead and hasn't moved for a long time, all of a sudden sits up in bed. At one point in time, there were doctors discouraging family to be near the brain dead next of kin for fear that the person would sit up, and they say, how can you say this person is dead? There are two other reasons given to consider the brain dead patient dead. One, which is embraced by the chief rabbi of Israel, goes back now to 1986, I believe, is that there's no spontaneous respiration. That's 100% true. You pull the plug, the person stops breathing. But what's questionable is that the definition of death? Many, many, many gallons of ink have been spilled by many people on both sides of this question. It's only possible that the definition of life is not respiration, but rather circulation. And when the Gemara says in Masechta Yuma that in order to determine whether the person under a mound of rubble is alive or dead, you would try to find out if he's breathing or not breathing, that's only because, as a general rule, breathing indicates that there is a heartbeat in circulation, and the lack of breathing indicates the opposite. So it could be that the breathing is determined because it's easy to find out one way or the other if there's breath or no breath. You put your finger there, put a mirror there, as opposed to a heartbeat, which can be very, very faint, and you don't pick it up, and you may be making a terrible mistake. Maybe there really is a heartbeat, and you thought there is not. It's just a technical issue. But fundamentally, it's certainly very possible that the definition of breathing is circulation. And if that's the case, this person's heart is beating normally, this blood is circulating normally. Yes, it's true. If not for the machine, everything would stop, because the breathing would stop and the heart would stop, everything would stop. But right now, it could be described as artificial breathing, but the result of that artificial breathing is a natural heartbeat, and therefore it's not at all clear that the lack of ability to breathe spontaneously makes you dead. What about Lou Gehrig's disease? Person can't breathe on his own. Pull the plug, he's dead right away. There are other pulmonary diseases of this sort. Would you consider that person dead? The person can finish Shas. The person can win a Nobel Prize. It's hard to consider such a person dead. But he can't breathe on his own. So the chief rabbinate said, well, it's a compound definition. On the one hand, it depends upon spontaneous respiration. But also, he has to be in an immobile state without being able to do anything or to move anywhere. Compound definitions are by definition questionable. Then there is the final reason to consider a brain dead person dead. It's been called halachic decapitation, which means that there is no connection at all between the head and the rest of the body. And the Gemara tells us in Masechta Chulin that decapitation means death. That's problematic on a number of grounds. Number one, of course decapitation means death. In the case of the Gemara, when the person is decapitated, all the blood is flowing out of the neck, so there's no longer a functioning circulatory system. And therefore, by definition, as we said before, it depends upon circulation, there's no longer a circulatory system, so the person is dead. What happens if you could somehow decapitate him and not have the circulation system dead? That was a famous story of the sheep experiment, where they decapitated a sheep and they sutured all the blood vessels. And there was a discussion, he's alive, he's dead, the sheep gave birth to a baby. I mean, the whole thing is different, because there it's not just it's a decapitation without the termination of a circulatory system, as opposed to the decapitation that we're describing. Now, the question then becomes, since brain death, there is a circulatory system, which is functioning very, very well, so it's arguable, it's not the same as decapitation. Moreover, in many instances of brain death, there is in fact blood going even into the brain. Different parts of the brain. There's the hypothalamus, which regulates body temperature and other things and even other parts of the brain. And in those cases, it seems that even if that would be the definition, the quote virtual decapitation didn't happen. And brain death is a complex matter, but you cannot be guaranteed that every case of brain death that there is no blood at all going to the brain. That's a matter of fact. So therefore, I'm just giving you some of the kitzur nimrut, some of the points of argument about brain death. I can speak for hours about it. But based upon this, if you, as a Rav, feel that you're not convinced that brain death is the is dead, then it's hard for you, it's impossible for you to declare the person dead and call the Chevra Kaddish. There were discussions about harvesting organs. That's even a little bit more complex. Some suggest that there's an overriding concern of saving somebody else's life, and maybe this person is called a trefa, and maybe you can even save a person at the expense of the life of a trefa. That's not for now, that discussion. So it's also complicated. There's a Meiri, there's a Minchas Chinuch about this. Is Ritzicha of a trefa Ritzicha or not? The Brisker Rav and his Chibon Rambam says yes, and Rav Yisraeli says no. There's a lot to be said about that kind of a question, but that's not the average case. I should say in conclusion that if someone in fact is brain dead, I believe that there's no point in extending that person's life. There may even be individuals who say that pulling the plug is not considered to be murder because all you're doing is preventing more air from coming in. That's a somewhat radical position, but it has a basis. As opposed to just cutting out his heart while he's still breathing, that doesn't seem to be justifiable, assuming that he's in fact alive. It is possible, in my view, and this is printed in Dr. Steinberg's medical halakhic encyclopedia, both in Hebrew and in English, that instead of having the intubator, the ventilator, set, as it often is in these cases, at 20 breaths a minute and 100% oxygen, which is far from the normal capacity of an individual, it could be set down to a normal breathing capacity, which is 21% oxygen and 6 to 10 breaths per minute. That, according to what's printed in that safer, would be permissible, and that would lead to an earlier end to the person's life. I should add that they now provide options to sign some of these cards with the proviso that the no organs be taken as long as there is a heartbeat, and the argument is being made that that's, how can you argue with that? Once the heart stops beating, the person is certainly dead, and then you can take organs for the sake of pikuach nefesh. That part, I believe, is correct. However, after speaking to transplant doctors and other people in the field, it seems it's impossible for this system to work for organ donation unless the death is orchestrated for a particular time. And that apparently involves certain interventions which would be violations of halacha if the assumption is that the person is alive. So that's not also really not much of an option for those who have opted for it. I would discourage it, again, for those who don't accept the brain dead is dead definition. As this famous Orthodox transplant doctor said to me, Rabbi, if you don't accept the definition of brain death, you can't have any of these transplants, either by doing it while the patient's heart is pumping, obviously. If you wait till the patient's heart stops and you consider them alive until that time, it's technically speaking an impossibility. This is a few years back. I don't think things have changed since then. This brings me to the end of my time. I want to thank you for the good question. I wish everybody, to go back to the first question, a Purim Sameach. Every rabbi should be happy with his congregants and try to balance the responsibilities to your community with those to your family. We should all be privileged to have a Freilich and Purim and many, many happy occasions together.
I want to thank Rebbe for joining with us on the call, and invite Rebbe back in 2 weeks in Mitzvah Hashem if he would like to be on the call with us again. And
if there's still more questions, I told you, if believe that, I'm willing to do it.
Gewaldig. I want to wish everyone an easy Tzom and a Freilich and Purim to everyone. see you on the call again, Bezrat Hashem. Thank you.